This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Women and Money by Susie Orman. Read for you by Nancy Lanari. Introduction. When this book was first published in 2007, I was convinced that women were finally ready to focus on being powerful with their money. Indeed, many women heard the call. The book connected with a few million readers. It reached the top of the New York Times bestseller list, and tens of thousands of women took the lessons of the book to heart and forged healthy and strong relationships with their money. But in the years since, I've come to realize that many more women, even some who bought the book, continued to ignore their issues with money, or they struggled to make confident decisions that would help them achieve lasting security. I was very confused by this. What was preventing women from being as powerful with money as they were in other areas of their lives? I have long said that self-worth determines one's net worth. When you are silent or silenced, it's very hard to get in touch with your self-worth. It is only when you speak your truth that you can be truly powerful. Starting in the fall of 2017, women began to speak their truth, and it suddenly started to make sense to me. When women in the entertainment industry bravely came forward and shared their experiences of sexual harassment, it was a harrowing, galvanizing moment that was soon followed by widespread reports of women in media being mistreated. In early 2018 came the female athletes who were able to speak truth to the doctor who had abused them years earlier, when they were vulnerable children. A movement began, #MeToo, and then another, #TimesUp. Women who for years silently carried the ache of shame and fear were now courageously standing in their truth and speaking out. Other women were speaking out on behalf of wage equality and fairness in the workplace. I am in awe of the women who have found their voices and are creating a safe space for others to speak up. They have ignited a national reckoning in which women are determined to demand more for themselves and from themselves. This movement will empower women for generations to come. There is no turning back. It was against this backdrop of women engaging from a place of power and action that I decided now was the time to restart the conversation about women and money. I truly believe that the promise of strength and security that is at the heart of women and money is more timely now than ever before. I offer this book to all of you who are ready to step up, own your power, and take control of your financial life. Let's get to work on building a life where you truly become the strong, smart, and secure women you were all born to be. That is my wish for each and every one of you. Susie Orman, September 2018. Chapter 1. Imagine What's Possible. When Women and Money was first published, it was my 8th book. All my previous books were written with the belief that gender is not a factor on any level in mastering the nuts and bolts of smart financial management. Women can invest, save, and handle debt just as well and skillfully as any man. I still believe that. Why would anyone think differently? So imagine my surprise when I learned that some of the people closest to me in my life were in the dark about their own finances, clueless, or in some cases, willfully resisting doing what they knew needed to be done. I'm talking about smart, competent, accomplished women who present a face to the world that is pure confidence and capability. Do you mean to tell me that I, Susie Orman, who make my living solving the financial problems of total strangers, couldn't spot the trouble brewing so close to home? I don't think I'm blind. I just think that these women became very, very good at hiding their troubles from me. Why not? They had years of practice hiding them from themselves. It began with a friend, a very high-powered businesswoman who handles millions and millions of dollars a year, who refused to sign will and trust documents I'd helped her prepare. I can't tell you why, but those papers sat on her desk for 3 years. She clearly had some kind of block that prevented her from simply signing her name and having the documents notarized. Then another friend, a woman with some amazing professional credentials, broke down and confessed that she had rung up such staggering bills over the years that she was too terrified to tell anyone and had no idea how to pay them off. Not long after, I heard from yet another friend who had finally woken up to the fact that her employer was paying her significantly less than every other executive of comparable rank in her company. Her division was one of the most profitable and consistent earners for the company, but still she just accepted the minimal increases her boss would hand her every year at review time. Upon further investigation, I learned that so many women in my life, friends, acquaintances, readers, people who'd been fans of my TV show and appearances, all had this stumbling block in common, an unknown factor that prevented them from doing the right thing with their money. Do you find yourself identifying with some of these emotions and actions? My experience is that if you are honest, you will answer yes. And there are many reasons why you are choosing to hold yourself back. Maybe it is your fear of the unknown. Maybe precisely because you hold it together in every other part of your life, you have a little streak of rebellion when it comes to money. Or maybe you just feel that things have gotten so far out of hand, you are embarrassed to ask for help and reveal just how much you don't know. What is important to understand is that this stumbling block is exhibited not only by women in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, but by women of all ages. Can I just act my age for a moment? I am 67 years old. I have lived through the transformation of women's roles at home, in society, and in the workplace. When I am with women in their 20s and 30s, what I love the most is that you aren't asking for equality. You expect it. You aren't doubting your talents relative to men. You know you've got what it takes. You seek relationships for their emotional possibilities, not their economic practicality. You don't need to be convinced of your worth. You own it, loud and proud. Amazing. Now, here's what I don't love. Like your mothers, aunts, and grandmothers, you share with me how confused and powerless you are with your money. You refuse to get involved with your money until some crisis occurs, and then you act out of fear. Women of all ages have the horrible habit of thinking money is just too complicated to master. You give up without even trying. You could not be more wrong. It is not a question of intelligence. You absolutely have what it takes to understand what you should be doing. A book with the title Women and Money must begin with the story of how far women have come financially. It's not only a remarkable tale of social progress, it's a reminder for us that changes that take place on a personal level, every day in small doses, add up to dramatic societal and cultural shifts over time. Women today make up nearly half of the total workforce in this country. Over the past 40 years, women's earnings have more than quadrupled. Women in the U.S. are the decision makers for about 40% of invested money. That works out to more than $11 trillion. Yes, trillion. 51% of all professional and managerial level workers are women. Women bring in half or more of the income in the majority of U.S. households. Women-owned businesses make up nearly 40% of all companies in the United States. There are more women than ever before who can count themselves among the country's millionaires. More women in upper management. We have a right to be proud of our progress. I am so honored to witness this revolution in my lifetime. I only wish it told the whole truth. Now, would you like to hear the other side of the story? 60% of women worry about not having enough money to last through retirement. 5 years ago, nearly half of women surveyed were still expressing concern that they might run out of money and become homeless in retirement. Another survey reports that just 1 in 5 women say they are confident they can make smart financial choices. Nearly 1/3 of women expect Social Security to be their primary source of income in retirement. Yet the typical monthly payout is less than $1,400. Did you know the poverty rate for women at least 65 years old is 40% higher than the rate for males? For years now, I have been in the privileged position of talking to thousands of women a year. I hear, see, and feel your fears, insecurities, and troubles, very often firsthand. And I have come face to face with this painful truth. For all the advancements that women have made in the past 40 years, and without a doubt, they are remarkable accomplishments, I am stunned by how little has really changed in the way so many women deal with money. There are huge disconnects at play here, between what we know and how we act, between what we think and what we say, between our ability as achievers and our financial underachieving, between how we present ourselves to the world and how we really feel about ourselves inside, between what we deserve in our lives and what we resign ourselves to, between the power we have within reach and the powerlessness that rules our actions. In 1980, when I was hired as a financial advisor for Merrill Lynch, I was one of the few women in the Oakland, California office. In the eyes of my male boss, that made me the perfect candidate to work with all the women who walked through the door. Back then, women who came to a brokerage firm looking for financial advice had, for the most part, inherited money, received it in a divorce, been widowed, or suddenly been thrust into a position of helping their parents handle their money. In only a few instances had women come in with money they'd made on their own. No matter the circumstances that brought them to the brokerage firm, they all had the same reason for being there. They did not want the responsibility of managing their money. I always felt they hired me simply to babysit their money for them. Nearly 40 years later, the story is often much the same. Regardless of the gains in our financial status, I know, and you know, that many women still don't want to take responsibility when it comes to their money. Yes, women are making more money than ever before, but they are not making more of what they make. What do I mean by that? Your retirement money sits in cash because you haven't figured out how to invest it properly, so you do nothing. You've convinced yourself that you'll be working forever, so the value of each paycheck becomes meaningless. After all, there will always be another one. Your closet houses the wardrobe of a powerful and stylish woman, but the dirty secret is that your credit cards are maxed out, and you don't know how you're going to pay them off. But it's not just about saving and investing. It's about not asking for a raise at work when you know you are being undervalued. It's about the fear and loathing you feel when it's time to pay the bills every month because you don't know exactly what you have, where it's going, and why there isn't more left when it's all said and done. It's about how you berate yourself all the time for not knowing more and doing more. Yet, you stay resigned to this feeling of helplessness and despair as time ticks away. This problem, in my opinion, is enormous and pervasive and universal. It crosses all ages, all races, all tax brackets. Who can deny the fact that there is a fundamental block at work here that is preventing women from becoming as powerful as they are meant to be? Not me. I would be the first one to tell you that everything you need to know to secure your financial future, to educate yourself, to make your life easy, it's all out there. Yours for the asking. But you don't ask. You don't want to know. I see this fundamental denial, this resistance, in so many women, no matter what they do, how they live, or where they are in their lives. I see you literally giving your money away rather than dealing with it. I see stay-at-home moms who work 24 hours a day and yet hand over all power and control to their husbands because they don't earn the money. I see successful single women who refuse to focus on what they need to do today to ensure their financial security years from now. I see women in second marriages who fail to protect the assets they accumulated before they remarried and who feel uncomfortable bringing up money issues with their new husbands. I see divorced women of all ages who go into full-blown panic mode when faced with the reality that they have no clue what money exists, what to do when they get their share of the settlement, and whether they will be able to maintain their lifestyle post-divorce. And the most heartbreaking of them all, I hear older women use words like powerless and worthless to describe themselves. These women are filled with regret when it comes to the way they've lived their financial lives. So why do you all do this to yourselves? Why are you voluntarily committing financial suicide and doing it with a smile on your face? Let me put it another way. Why is it that women who are so competent in all other areas of their lives cannot find the same competence when it comes to matters of money? I have asked this question of myself and others over and over. Of course, there is no one answer. After much contemplation, here is what I have come up with. The matter of women and money is clearly a complicated issue that has much to do with our history and traditions, both societal and familial. These deep-seated issues are major hurdles to overcome, major tides to turn, and that doesn't happen overnight. It can take generations to affect change of this magnitude in our daily behavior. We'll explore these issues in greater depth in the chapters ahead, because they are absolutely a root cause of this problem. But we'll have a look at this on a behavioral level too, since traits that are fundamental to our nature clearly affect how we approach money as well. Consider this. It's a generally accepted belief that nurturing comes as a basic instinct to women. We give of ourselves. We take care of our family, our friends, our colleagues. It's in our nature to nurture. Our inner nurturer reigns supreme. But we don't take care of our money as well as we take care of spouses, partners, children, pets, plants, and whatever else is in our lives that we love and cherish. Why? I want you to think about that question. The answer is critical to uncovering what is at work here and what is holding you back. So, I'll ask it again. Why don't we show our money the same care and attention that we shower on every other important relationship in our lives? Because we don't have a relationship with our money. Correction. We do have a relationship with our money. It's just a totally dysfunctional one. What holds you back is that you simply won't bring yourself to take care of yourself financially, especially if those actions compete with taking care of those you love. You do for everyone before you do for yourself. Your nature is to nurture. You take care of everyone before you take care of yourself. Your kids, your parents, your spouse, your siblings, your colleagues, your pets. Everyone gets your full attention. No matter how good your intentions may be, they are nonetheless draining you. The challenge is to finally learn and accept that to be truly powerful in your life requires making money moves that work for you. You are never powerful in life until you are powerful with money. Now, I am not suggesting you replace nurturer with narcissist. I do not want you to discard your generosity or shed your supportive and kind nature. This book is not about becoming more by becoming more selfish. Far from it. I simply want you to give to yourself as much as you give of yourself. I want you to think about financial self-care. So then, let's turn this relationship theory around and ask ourselves the following question. In order to become competent and successful in handling our money, in order to become the fully responsible women we know we should be, what is required of us? We have to develop a healthy, honest relationship with our money. And we have to see this relationship as a reflection of our relationship with ourselves. I can't put it any more simply or emphatically. How we behave toward our money, how we treat our money, speaks volumes about how we perceive and value ourselves. If we aren't powerful with money, we aren't powerful, period. What is at stake here is not just money. It's far bigger. This is about your sense of who you are and what you deserve. Lasting net worth comes only when you have a healthy and strong sense of self-worth. And right now, the money disconnect, this dysfunctional relationship, is a barrier to both. Once you fully appreciate this and hold it as an absolute truth, you will also understand that your destiny depends on the health of this relationship. Are you honestly prepared to roll the dice on this one? Or would you rather feel that you have the ability, the determination, the power to make this relationship work, as surely as you know how to nurture and give care to all the people you love in your life? How do you repair this relationship? The same way you would repair any relationship that is damaged. By acknowledging your mistakes, taking responsibility, and resolving to act in a way that will bring about change for the better. In the case of you and your money, that means making smart and strong money moves. Moves with the goal of making you feel more powerful and secure. If you show money the respect it deserves today and carry that through in all your actions, then one day, when you can no longer take care of it, your money will take care of you. Respecting your relationship with money, you see, is the key not only to your security and independence, but to your happiness as well. Now, let's talk about happiness for a moment. The simple fact is that nothing more directly affects your happiness than money. Oh, I know. Some of you are just horrified by this notion, maybe even offended. Susie, how could you? Happiness is about all the things money can't buy. Health, love, respect, right? Absolutely true. All of these are essential to a happy life. All are determined by who you are and not what you have. But the kind of happiness I am talking about is your quality of life, the ability to enjoy life, to live life to its fullest potential. And I challenge anyone to tell me that such things aren't factors in your overall happiness. Let's just walk through this together. Yes, I know that your health and the health of your loved ones is paramount. But explain to me what would happen if, God forbid, any one of you fell ill. Wouldn't you want the best care that money can buy? Wouldn't you be grateful that you were in a good health plan? And isn't it money that puts the roof over your head? And money that allows you to move to a neighborhood with a great public school system? And money that allows you to retire early or quit your job when you go back to school to pursue a new career? In a survey I saw called Authentic Happiness, there was not a single question or answer that contained the word money. Why is it that we are so reluctant to embrace the notion that money is a factor in determining our happiness? What bothers me about this is that I think it's a lie not to acknowledge the power that money has to make our lives better and happier. It's not a subject for polite company? Is that what you've been raised to believe? Well, I'm here to tell you that this isn't just a problem of semantics. I believe that this conspiracy of silence is another reason why so many women are in the dark about financial matters. I have often said that we must be careful of our words, for words become actions. Well, the opposite of that is true, too. Silence leads to inaction. We don't talk about money with our friends, our parents, our children. In a 2015 survey, 4 out of 5 women said they have a hard time talking about money with someone they are close to. Many of those women said it was just too personal. Seriously? You can dish and confide in your besties. You can overshare on social media. But talking about money is taboo? It's too personal? That's where we get in trouble. How are we supposed to teach our children? How are we supposed to educate ourselves if there isn't a free and frank flow of information about money? Why do we behave so carelessly with our money? Would we do that if we believed our very happiness depended on it? Let me put it this way. If we persist in denying money its place in our lives, if we don't give it the respect it most certainly deserves, then it will surely lead to unhappiness. I am asking you now to harness the incredible intelligence and competence that serve you so well in all the other aspects of your life and apply it to your money. Anyone who has it in them to run a household, run a company, run a department of a company, run a carpool, or run a marathon is fully equipped to take control here. Anyone who is a supportive and caring wife, partner, mother, sister, daughter, best friend, caretaker, aunt, grandmother, or colleague has all the skills necessary to forge a solid relationship with money and make the kind of smart money choices that will support rather than sabotage you. That's what it means to be smart, strong, and secure. Knowing what to do and what not to do, and having the conviction and confidence to go out and do it, not just think about it or intend to do it next week or next month, to actually do it right now. Make that commitment to yourself first, and I will help you. And together, let's imagine what's possible when you do. Imagine what it feels like to be freed from the self-doubt that holds you down. Imagine knowing that when you are more powerful with your money, you will have even more energy to flood your communities with your intelligence and generosity. Imagine opening the credit card bill each month and knowing you will be able to pay it off. Imagine knowing you have done everything to take care of your family if something happens to you. Imagine staying in a relationship purely for love, not because you have no idea how you would make it financially on your own. Imagine loving yourself enough to choose a partner you don't have to rescue. Imagine owning your home outright. No more mortgage payments. Imagine knowing you will be able to retire comfortably one day. Imagine raising children who've learned from you the wisdom of living within your means rather than living out of control. Imagine knowing you have helped your parents live full lives without fear or uncertainty right to the end. The thought of more powerful and confident women on the loose in our country makes me so hopeful. The payoff for your commitment will extend beyond your finances. Having a healthy relationship with money puts you in a position to have better relationships with everyone in your life. It all flows together. A woman who is more financially confident and secure is a happier woman. And a happier woman is going to be better able to nurture, share, and give support to all those in her life. All of it is possible. Chapter 2. No shame, no blame. In order to build a healthy relationship with money, there are some attitudes I'm going to ask you to cast off forever. First among them are two of the heaviest weights women carry, invisible twin obstacles of our past, the burden of shame and the tendency to blame. You don't feel confident in your knowledge of how money works, so you hide behind the shame of it, deferring decisions to others or staying stuck in a pattern of inaction. This is just as true for my 20-something friends as it is for their 50, 60, and 70-something mothers and grandmothers. You wrap yourself in the cloak of shame rather than reveal your shortcomings. You, after all, are a doer. You have to be all things to all people. Mother, wife, dutiful daughter, supportive friend, amazing colleague or entrepreneur, school volunteer, cheerleader at home and at work. No room to betray uncertainty in that picture. No time to learn, anyway. Who has the time? You're so busy. And besides, you tell yourself, I probably should have learned that ages ago. When did everybody else learn this and not me? Maybe you were absent that day. At this point, it's simply too embarrassing to reveal the depths of what you do not know. And where the mantle of shame stops, the tendency to blame kicks in. It's not my fault, you tell me. A, society. B, my parents. C, my husband or ex-husband. D, all of the above. Held me back. Where were the role models? No one taught me. No one showed me how. Money decisions were always made for me. Now, I'm not belittling these factors or making fun of you. There's a lot of legitimacy in these complaints. Long-standing traditions in society and in the home have not made it easy for women to get the financial education they need to become competent, informed participants in their own affairs. Even today, no one is going to hand it to you. You have to go get it for yourself. It amazes me that a person can go through 12 years of school, 4 years of college, and then on to graduate study, and nowhere along the way was she required to take a single class on personal finance. But let me ask you this. Where does blame get you? The answer is nowhere. Blame renders you powerless. You must get past blame to become who you are meant to be. And what does shame do to you? Shame only serves to hold you back. This book is about facing forward, not staying stuck in the past. It is fine to understand how we got here, but the next breath must contain a resolve to move ahead into a future that looks entirely different, into a destiny that is all yours. I want you to use your past to propel you into your future, rather than keep you in the dark of what no longer exists. Easy for you to say, Susie. Is that what you're thinking? Are you wondering how I could possibly know about your situation? After all, I'm rich. I have everything I need, everything I want. You're right. I'm rich. But that was not always the case. Do you think I was raised in a family that had money and paid for a fabulous education? Do you think I had an MBA from some fancy business school? Nothing could be further from the truth. Maybe you think I married money. Not true. In fact, I never got married until I was 59, which is probably why I have money today. Let me tell you where I came from and how I got here, so you will understand that there is no excuse, no amount of shame or blame that can hold you back and keep you from becoming all you are meant to be and having all that you deserve. Susie's story. When I was a little girl, I had a speech impediment. I couldn't pronounce my R's, S's, or T's properly. So words such as beautiful, for example, came out as boobital. To this day, if you listen closely when I speak, you can still hear it. Words like fear and fair and bear and beer sound the same. And a word like shouldn't comes out sounding like shouldn't. Back then, because I couldn't speak well, I also couldn't read very well. In grammar school on the south side of Chicago, I had to take reading exams and would always score among the lowest in the class. One year, a teacher decided that he would seat us according to our reading scores. There were my three best friends in the first three seats of the first row, while I was banished to the last seat in the sixth row. If I always secretly felt dumb, it was now officially confirmed for everyone to see. Talk about feeling ashamed. This feeling that I couldn't make it scholastically continued to haunt me throughout high school and on into college. I knew I would never amount to anything, so why even bother to try? Nevertheless, in my family and in the families of my friends, it was a given that we'd all go to college. In my case, I knew that I would have to pay for college myself, because my parents were having a hard time with money. The only options for me were community college or a state school. I applied to the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and to my amazement, even though I did not score well on my SATs, I was accepted. When I arrived, I met with a guidance counselor who asked me what I wanted to study. I told him that I wanted to become a brain surgeon. He looked at my grades and said, "I don't think so. You don't have what it takes. Why not try something easier?" I did a little investigation and found out that the easiest major was social work, so I signed up for that. Why not take the easy way out? Why try harder? During my first year at the University of Illinois, I lived in the Florida Avenue residences in room 222 and worked as a dishwasher in the dormitory's cafeteria 7 days a week to pay the bills. In my second year, I shared a one-bedroom apartment off campus with two friends I had met in the dorm, Carol Morgan and Judy Jacklin. Judy had a hilarious boyfriend named John Belushi, and the four of us had quite the adventure for the next 3 years. Yes, this is the very same John Belushi who went on to superstardom on Saturday Night Live. Judy and John got married, and the rest is history. But that's a story for another book. I was supposed to graduate in 1973, but my degree was withheld because I hadn't fulfilled the language requirement. Once again, it was the shame of my grade school years holding me back. If I had trouble with English, what made me think I could learn a foreign language? I decided to leave school without my degree. I wanted to see America. I wanted to see what a hill looked like, a mountain, the Grand Canyon. I borrowed $1,500 from my brother to buy a Ford Econoline van, and with the help of my friend Mary Corlin, a great friend to this day, converted the van into a place I could sleep during the drive across country. I convinced three friends, Lori, Sherry, and Vicky, to come with me. I was way too scared to try this on my own. With $300 and a converted van to my name, we set out to see America. Sherry and Vicky jumped out in Los Angeles, but Lori and I continued on to Berkeley, California. As we drove through the hills on the day of our arrival, we were stopped by a man with a red flag who held up traffic so trees that had been cut down could be cleared. That year, a frost in the Berkeley Hills killed many of the eucalyptus trees. I got out of the van to watch and walked up to the man with the red flag and asked him if they needed any help. He pointed me to the boss, and before we knew it, Lori and I had landed our first jobs, working for Coley Tree Service for $3.50 an hour. We worked as tree clearers for 2 months, living out of the van and using a friend's home nearby to shower. When it was time to move on, I applied for a job as a waitress at the Buttercup Bakery, a great little place where we used to get our coffee. To my delight, I got the job. While I worked at the Buttercup, I faced up to my shame of not having finished college and took Spanish classes at Hayward State University. Finally, in 1976, I got my degree from the University of Illinois. I was an official college graduate working as a waitress. I stayed at the Buttercup Bakery, where I made about $400 a month, until 1980, when I was 29 years old. After 6 years of waitressing, I had this thought that I could be more than just a waitress. I wanted to own my own restaurant. I called up my parents and asked to borrow $20,000. My mom said, "Honey, where do you expect us to come up with this? We don't have that kind of money to give you." I should have known better than to ask for something I knew my parents didn't have to give away. There's nothing a parent wants more than to help a child realize a dream. I knew my mother would have done anything to help me, but she was powerless. I felt awful. The next day at work, a man I had been waiting on for 6 years, Fred Hasbrook, noticed that I wasn't my usual cheerful self. "What's wrong, sunshine? You don't look happy," he said. I told Fred about having asked my parents for a $20,000 loan. Fred ate his breakfast and then talked to some of the other customers I'd been waiting on all those years. Before he left the restaurant, he came up to the counter and handed me a personal check for $2,000, a bunch of other checks and commitments from the other customers that totaled $50,000, and a note that read, "This is for people like you, so that your dreams can come true. To be paid back in 10 years, if you can, with no interest." I couldn't believe my eyes. "I have to ask you a question," I said to Fred. "Are these checks going to bounce like all of mine do?" "No, Susie," he said. "What I want you to do is put this in a money market account at Merrill Lynch until you've raised enough money to open your restaurant." "Fred," I said, "what is Merrill Lynch and what is a money market account?" After a brief tutorial from Fred, I went to the Oakland office of Merrill Lynch to deposit the money. I was assigned to the broker of the day, the one who handled all the walk-in clients that day. My broker was named Randy. I told Randy the story of how I had come by this money and that it needed to stay safe and sound. I told Randy that I made only $400 a month as a waitress and that I needed to raise more money in order to open up my own business. He looked at me and said, "Susie, how would you like to make a quick $100 a week?" "You bet," I said. That's about what I make as a waitress. Just sign here on the dotted line and we'll see what we can do, he said. I did exactly what he asked, never thinking that it was stupid or dangerous for me to sign blank papers. Randy worked for Merrill Lynch, after all, and Fred said it was a great place to do business. Now, before I go any further, I just want to say that this is not a commentary on Merrill Lynch. Merrill Lynch is a fine, upstanding, and honest brokerage firm. But the bosses in the Oakland office had hired someone who didn't uphold their standards. If you have an account with Merrill, or want to open an account with Merrill, go right ahead. This particular bad seed is long gone. But more on that later. It turned out that after I left that day, Randy had filled out the papers I had signed to make it look as if I could afford to risk the money I had deposited into the Merrill Lynch account. He got me into one of the more speculative investing strategies, buying options. At first, I was making great money. I was amazed. I found the perfect location for my restaurant and was having plans drawn up by an architect. My dream was within reach. Other people believed in me and lent me more money. We were off and running. That is, until the markets turned. Within 3 months, I'd lost all the money in the account. All of it. I didn't know what to do. I knew I owed a lot of money, and I knew I had no way to pay it back. I was still making only $400 a month. During this time, I had been following what Randy was doing and was trying to learn as much as possible. I watched Wall Street Week on PBS every Friday night. I read Barron's and the Wall Street Journal. I taped the pages with the stock and option prices to my bedroom walls. After all the money was lost, I said to myself, "Hey, if Randy can be a broker, I can be a broker too. After all, it seems like they just make people broker." I got dressed in my best red and white striped Sassoon pants, tucked them into my white cowboy boots, and put on a blue silk top. I thought I looked great. So did my friends at the Buttercup, who wished me luck as I set off for my job interview to become a stockbroker at the very office that had lost me all my money. 5 men interviewed me that day, and all of them asked why I had dressed that way. I told them I didn't know I wasn't supposed to dress this way. It wasn't as if there were lots of female role models I could learn from. Before I knew it, I was sitting before the branch manager, who looked as shocked as all the other brokers who just interviewed me. During the interview, he actually shared his belief that women belonged barefoot and pregnant. Seeing that I had nothing to lose, I asked him how much he'd pay me to get pregnant. He said $1,500 a month, and to my astonishment, he hired me, though he also said that he figured I'd be out of there in 6 months. To this day, I am convinced I got the job only because he had a women's quota to fill. Before I left the office, I was handed a book on dressing for success. I took the book and went straight to Macy's, opened an account, and charged $3,000 worth of clothes. I was never so scared in my life as that first day on the job. I knew I didn't belong there. All the stockbrokers drove Mercedes, BMWs, and Jaguars. I drove a 1967 Volvo station wagon that I bought when I sold the van. They parked their cars in the parking lot. For the first 6 months, I parked my car on the street because I couldn't afford the lot. I would get tickets, knowing that I'd go to court and ask to work the tickets off with community service. The other brokers would eat out at fancy restaurants after the market closed. I got in my car and went to Taco Bell every single day and ate by myself. Still, I felt so lucky and blessed, for even though I was terrified, I was also excited. Every day I was learning new words and concepts. A whole world was opening up to me. It was while studying to take my Series 7 exam, a test all brokers have to pass in order to sell stocks, that I read a rule stating that a broker needed to know his or her customer. Meaning, a broker could not invest a person's money speculatively or risk their money if the customer could not afford to lose it. I had told Randy that I couldn't afford to lose my money, that I was saving up to open a business, that all the money was loaned to me. I realized that Randy had broken this know your customer rule. I marched into the manager's office and told him that he had a crook working for him. He told me that I was a college graduate and I had to know what I was doing when I signed those papers. Besides, he said, that crook made him a lot of money. He told me to sit down, shut my mouth, and keep studying. I went back to my desk. I remembered that when I was hired, the manager had told me I wouldn't last 6 months. That was just 3 months away. What did I have to lose? What had happened to me was not right. I had time to make that money back. I was still young. But what if Randy had done this to my mother or my grandmother or any older person? My conscience wouldn't let me keep quiet. I had to do something, for I knew it was better to do what was right than what was easy. I ended up suing Merrill Lynch while I worked for them. Now, what I hadn't realized at the time was that because I had sued them, they couldn't fire me. Who knew? Months and months passed as the case proceeded, and during that time, I became one of the more successful brokers in the office. Before the lawsuit made it to court, Merrill ended up settling with me. They paid me back all the money plus interest, which allowed me to pay back all the people who had loaned me money. Whenever I tell this story, people want to know what happened to Fred. When I repaid the money, it surprised me that I didn't hear from him. From time to time, I would write or call and leave a message, but I never heard back. Then, in May of 1984, I got the following letter from Fred, who, it turned out, had suffered a stroke, the reason I hadn't heard from him all that time. Dear Susie, I had not intended to be this long in writing you a note of appreciation for your check repaying our loan from the Buttercup era. However, it seems that words don't come as easily to me as they once did. The check arrived at a critical time in my affairs, and for that I am grateful. That loan may have been one of the best investments that I will ever make. Who else could have invested in a counter girl with porcelain blue eyes and a million-dollar personality and watched that investment mature into a successful career woman who still has porcelain blue eyes and a million-dollar personality? How few investors have that opportunity. I am working hard to get my affairs in order so that you and I can both make each other some money. Until then, I would like to remain on your list of friends who wish you the very best of everything, no matter what paths you may travel in the future. Fondly, Fred Hasbrook. Fred has passed away, but he will remain a part of my life forever. I'll never forget the man who believed in me, who helped me put aside my shame and rewrite the story history had handed me. Rewrite the story history has handed you. I tell you my story not to impress you, but to inspire you. I want you to understand that it is not just our education or what society has handed us that determines what we can create for ourselves. It is how you decide to write your own story, how you decide to live your life. There are countless examples throughout history and from various cultures of how women have been disinherited and disenfranchised. So it's no wonder that women today struggle with their money. It's a foreign experience. Throughout the ages, it was the man's job to bring money into the family. If you were to lay out a historical graph that charted women's evolution from non-earners to earners, our new roles as income producers would barely rate as a blip. These changes are that new. And yet women have come so far, so fast in the workplace since the beginning of the women's movement. Remember the statistics I cited in the last chapter? Who could have predicted such rapid, dramatic change in such a short time? At work, we have overthrown traditions that were centuries, millennia old. So why is it that we haven't made the same evolutionary leap when it comes to our personal finances? When Women and Money was published in 2007, my explanation for how this could be leaned on traditions. Despite what was going on outside in the world, inside the home, traditional roles held tight. Those roles dictated that men handled the finances. Many successful career women at that time most likely had mothers who abdicated their role in major financial decisions to their husbands, as their grandmothers did and their great-grandmothers before them. The beat of history marching on. Today we have more women who grew up with mothers who were working outside of the home, many of them the sole or primary breadwinner. Yet women are still not finding it easy or natural to be powerful with their money. As I explained in the introduction, I believe this is because women, despite great progress, have been struggling in many other facets of their life to speak their truth and embrace their power. How we relate to money is a reflection of what we feel about ourselves. As far as women have come during my lifetime, there are still traditions, stigmas, and cultural biases to overcome. The recent wave of women finding their voice and being heard makes me hopeful that women are entering a new stage of awareness and intent. In keeping with my challenge that we use the past to propel us into a new future, that we rewrite the story that history has handed us, I am asking you now to see yourself as an agent of change in your own life and on a global scale. This change is necessary and urgent, given the world we live in today. Consider these realities of our 21st century life. Retirement security is now your responsibility. Pensions have become rare, on their way to extinct in the corporate world. The retirement plans now offered through work require you to step up and save some of your current salary and to figure out exactly how to invest that money so it can support you decades from now. Neither task is easy. And please don't talk yourself into thinking you will be able to get by on Social Security. Social Security was never meant to be the primary source of retirement income. The average monthly benefit is around $1,400. How secure would your retirement be if that's all you had to pay your bills? What that means is that you are going to have to rely on yourself in retirement much, much more than your parents and grandparents did. With the divorce rate hovering around 40%, many women at some point in their lives will be solely responsible for managing their money. That also holds true for the increasingly larger segment of the female population who delay marriage or choose not to marry at all. Nearly one in five women over the age of 25 has never married, more than double the percentage in 1960. And of course, this also includes the growing number of single-parent households. Even in the marriages that work, money is more of an issue than ever before, especially in homes where there is a stay-at-home mother. Making ends meet on one income is a huge challenge these days. I can tell you that the only way to make it work, and I mean the marriage, not the finances, is for both partners to share responsibility for the money decisions. Otherwise, you will be undone by money arguments. women live longer than men. A 65-year-old woman today has an expected average lifespan that is nearly 3 years longer than a 65-year-old man. About one in three women age 65 and older lives on her own. The point is that the family finances will be your concern and yours alone at some juncture. The time to prepare for that is now. I have seen too much heartache, frustration, and costly financial mistakes made by women who are thrust into the job of financial manager later in life and have no interest or clue about what to do. I never want any of you to find yourself dealing with that fear and anxiety. We are also expected to live a lot longer than our parents or grandparents. At the same time, our mothers and fathers are also living longer. That's the good news, but it comes with additional responsibility. Your parents may well need your financial help to maintain their lifestyle as they age, or to pay for care they could eventually need. You get the idea. This isn't your grandmother's world anymore. We are trailblazers. For the sake of all the mothers who came before you, and for the sake of the daughters who will come after you, I'm calling on you to move out of the past and into the future, armed with knowledge and confidence. That means leaving behind old attitudes, old excuses, and tired alibis for not becoming as fully competent and able in the area of personal finance as you are in every other role you inhabit in your life. If you are asked to describe yourself without using the words mother, grandmother, or daughter, or your job title, I want to hear you say, I am powerful. I am secure. I am in control of my financial destiny. No more hiding behind excuses. It's too easy to hide. No shame, no blame. Allowing shame to hold you back? Too easy. Blaming others rather than taking responsibility for yourself? Too easy. Today, I am asking you to do what's right, not what's easy. Building a new relationship with money. To build your new relationship with money, I am first going to ask you to do an exercise with me in which you will voyage back to your childhood. It is there that you will discover the foundation for your current relationship with money. We are all quick to acknowledge that experiences on the playground, in the classroom, and within the privacy of our childhood homes shaped who we are now. But we don't extend that to an appreciation of how our money memories continue to play a role in how we navigate the world today. Your money memories. I am going to guide you to reconnecting with your earliest money experience. Those of you who have read my book, The 9 Steps to Financial Freedom, will recognize this exercise. It never fails to reveal profound truths about how we relate to money. I want you to think back to your very first memory of money, when money represented something real to you. Don't think too hard about this. What is the very first thing that pops into your head? A favorite present you received at 5? A present you didn't receive at 12? A valuable lesson on the value of money from a grandparent or parent? The ache of hearing or sensing money arguments between your parents? Watching the financial fallout from your parents divorcing? Once you identify your most powerful money memory, start writing. The more specific and honest you are, the stronger you will emerge. Do you remember what you were wearing that day? Or what time of year it was? What was